As one grows older, the past catches up with one more and more. Now and then, I still dream of it, although less than I used to, thank God. I dream of being there at the so-called People's Court, and that this time I'm condemned to death. That's a real nightmare. When we were moved from Stadelheim, where we younger ones were interned, to another prison, a prison guard who likely meant well took us through the death row candidates yard. There we saw Professor Huber, Willy Graf, and Alexander Schmorell again, who had all been condemned to death. To this very day, it is the most powerful memory I have of my friends, a situation that lasted no more than half a minute. What can one say to each other? We were being taken to a different prison, while the others were waiting for the machine 30 yards away that would literally strike off their heads. In the end, we said, all the best. What are you meant to say? One day, Sophie Scholl gave Hans Hirzel, a clergyman's son, some leaflets. Hirzel then asked me if I would help him distribute them. It was the very evening before I started at the Reich Labor Service, in other words, summer 1942. So this was relatively early on, 9 months before I was sentenced by the People's Court. I knew very well that the leaflet was explosive, the death penalty if you got caught with it. We knew that because the newspapers repeatedly carried reports of death sentences against communists. What the leaflet said was, in my view, absolutely right. The same issues stood at the center of all our discussions. I didn't know Hans Scholl personally at the time. I just knew him as a Hitler youth leader. Perhaps he had spoken to me in this capacity, or reprimanded me, I don't recall. I only saw Sophie Scholl in the context of Hans Hirzel's sister Susanne, who was also sentenced. But even then, I didn't get to know her personally. Back then, at 16 or 17, one didn't speak to a girl who was even only a little older than oneself, no matter how much one might have wanted to. I remember 1 or 2 days before my trial, as I sat there in the cell, a prison warden handed me a sheet of paper. I was in a bad way. Through lack of food, I was in bad physical shape. I'd been arrested as a soldier in France. My mother had sent me a letter with a cutting about the death sentences against the Scholls carried out on February 22, 1943. My mother wrote underneath, "I hope you don't have anything to do with this." From that time on, I prepared for my arrest. I was expecting to be sentenced to death, of course. I knew I'd be condemned as a public enemy. Someone who distributed leaflets of that kind, as I had done or had helped to, clearly fulfilled the Nazi paragraphs about aiding the enemy, high treason and so on. As a rule, all these paragraphs carried the death penalty. I, too, could pretty much count on it. So, as I said before, I was handed this sheet of paper in the cell and I read it through. It was the charge against me, but I just didn't understand what it was about. In what way had I committed high treason? But high treason means conspiring against one's own government or working for its replacement. Only I didn't know that at the time. Sitting on the cold cell floor in Neudeck prison, I could have done with help. The prison is still used today as a women's prison, I believe. A few days later, a man named Klein visited me. "Out of the cell," the guard said. A tall man stood there. He introduced himself as Klein, saying he was my legal counsel. All he could say to my charge sheet was, "There's not much I can do. I'll recommend you to the mercy of the court." Then I returned to my cell. That was tough. And then I had to come to terms with the fact that the People's Court would soon condemn me on April 19th, 1943. My father visited me twice in prison. First, in the Gestapo jail here in Munich. It was in the Wittelsbach Palais, which no longer exists. One of the meanest Gestapo interrogators, Mahler, let him in. I was fetched from my cell and allowed to speak with my father on the stairs. He had put on his party badge for the occasion. Herr Mahler wore his party badge too. I think he addressed my father as party comrade. Party comrade Müller, you have 3 minutes, no more. These 3 minutes are on my own responsibility because I'm not allowed to do this. My father stood there facing me. After a few moments, he began to cry. He asked me how I was. I said, fine. Although I was locked up in a cell with 3 times as many people as it was made for, etc. That was one visit. He visited me again in a later prison. I learned later that visiting me had been extremely difficult for him, because he was afraid they would find out about it at his work. If that had happened, he would have been instantly fired, of course. Then he would have been workless and the family would have suffered. One has to grant him that.
Directly after the war, I met Inge Scholl and I said, we ought really to bring charges. But she was against it, although it's there in the leaflets. The time of reckoning will come. Once the war is over, out of love for future generations, an example must be set, so that never again does anyone have the faintest desire to try doing this again. And don't forget the little rogues in the system. Remember their names, so that no one escapes. Don't let them change sides at the last moment when these atrocities are over and pretend nothing happened. That's what it says in the leaflets. But Inge Scholl was against it. She said, it's peace now. Let's not go on quarreling. That's how she felt. I thought, okay, she's the important one. I didn't want to go through with it alone. I couldn't have.
I found post-war society in Germany terrible, simply terrible. Silence lay over everything like a black cloud. That did some people good, but it didn't do us any good. I was no longer a part of society. The Americans said, you can't live in this country anymore. They locked you away like a criminal. They killed your friends. Here is a visa for you. You can travel to the USA at the expense of the army and study there. I thought it over pretty hard. It was the Scholl's father, Robert, who dissuaded me. What'll you do in America? He said. This is where the work is and the ruins.
I knew that I'd been reported to the police by my 2 comrades in Stuttgart. I saw that they were both scared stiff of me. It was an embarrassing situation. So I told them they needn't be afraid of me. They said that they thought I was dead. I didn't find that too nice that they had speculated on this whole business costing me my life.
The Südbayerische Volkszeitung reports on the outcome of the denazification court trial against the 2 Gestapo officers, Fischer and Mahler, on December 22, 1949. The state attorney demanded prison sentences of 10 years for Fischer and 8 for Mahler, including loss of civil rights, and made a 3rd application for their arrest. When the court resumed, in order to pronounce judgment after 4 hours' deliberation, the 2 defendants had disappeared. Their defense attorney handed over a letter in which they explained they had no intention of appearing for the pronouncement of judgment and of exposing themselves to the communist terror. The court then pronounced judgment. Fischer received 5 years and Mahler 4 years. To the amusement of visitors, the president of the court issued a warrant of arrest to the empty dock.
Mahler and Fischer had gone into hiding. The German police authorized a search for them, but they were never found. The counterintelligence corps had taken them on and had procured safe houses for them. The judges Freisler and Stier are killed by a bomb shortly before the end of the war. Gauleiter Giesler shoots himself with his service revolver. The assessor Breithaupt, a concentration camp guard instructor, is shot by his chauffeur. Reich attorney Weiersberg hands himself over to the Americans and disappears forever. Deputy Secretary Kugelmeier fights in vain for his full retirement benefits. Rector Wüst of Munich University lives out his life unmolested. Gestapo boss Schäfer becomes managing director of Hugo Stinnes and registered manager of the Scheidt machine factory at Limburg. Gestapo officer Marmon orders 100 executions by shooting shortly before the end of the war. Trenka organizes the deportation of Jews in Budapest. After the war, he works as a real estate agent in Munich. Kriminaloberssekretär Mahler goes into hiding and joins Klaus Barbie's staff with the American Intelligence Service, the Counterintelligence Corps, the CIC. The Gestapo informer Riester likewise works for the CIC, for the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, and as safety officer for Daimler-Benz. Kriminaloberssekretär Mohr works in the spa administration at Bad Dürkheim. The only person to receive a punishment is the lecture hall superintendent at Munich University, Jakob Schmidt.